Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be a cynical move by President Trump, disguised as an act of compassion in reversing his policy of separating children from their parents at the southern border. The former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Clinton, Doris Meisner, joins us to discuss how Trump's executive order is designed to do away with the consent decree known as the Flores Agreement, which Doris signed in 1997, that protects immigrant children in federal detention, placing them in the least restrictive conditions for no more than 20 days, with guarantees of food, water, medical treatment in facilities subject to inspection. Working on two tracks through the courts to undo the Flores Agreement and via the Republican bills in the House, which Trump has loaded up with money for his wall, it is unclear whether Trump will have the children join their parents in jails or the parents join their children in detention. But what is emerging is a grim prospect of indefinite detention for these families and a mendacious raid on the Treasury for politically connected contractors to build prisons and detention facilities for growing numbers escaping violence in Central America, who could instead be given ankle monitors and be housed with relatives pending their appearance in immigration court. Then we'll examine our immigration prison system, about to be gifted with a bonanza of pork barrel by Trump, and speak with Christina Fialo, the co-founder and co-executive director of Freedom for Immigrants, a nonprofit advocacy group seeking to abolish immigration detention. She joins us to discuss her article at the Los Angeles Times, "Don't Stop with Family Separation, End the Whole Immigration Prison System," and describe conditions inside the existing facilities that are about to be overrun with more detainees held for indefinite periods. Then finally, we'll look into plans by the Trump administration to merge the Department of Labor with the Department of Education and speak with Seth Harris, a distinguished scholar at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, who served for 4 years as Deputy U.S. Secretary of Labor and 6 months as Acting U.S. Secretary of Labor. We will discuss what Seth describes as a solution in search of a problem and Minority Chair of the Senate Education Committee, Senator Patrick Murray's response that Mick Mulvaney's plan is unrealistic, unhelpful, and futile. And joining us now is Doris Meisner, the former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, who's now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doris Meisner.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, thank you, Doris. And it looks as though President Trump reversing himself on taking children away from their parents on the southern border in his executive order is going to butt up against the Flores settlement, which was a consent decree agreed to by the Clinton administration and the ACLU and other plaintiffs in litigation in 1997. And it's known as the Flores Settlement, which sets standards for unaccompanied minors who were in the custody of federal authorities. Were you the INS commissioner at the time?
Yes, yes. I signed the settlement, and it's a consent decree, and it's had the force of law ever since.
So I guess the issue now is, and the confusion that many have, and I certainly have, is what's going to happen now? Will the children join their parents in jail, or will the parents join their children in detention?
Well, we don't know, but if I were to take a guess, it would be that the children will join their parents in detention.
And that is basically much a harsher form of detention than the current detention that children are in now, right?
Well, you know, this would be prospective, and so presumably starting today. And so it would mean that the government would be putting people into facilities that are presumably appropriate, and there certainly has been what's called family detention in the past. They would be needing to expand that family detention since that is the predominant characteristic of the flow of these of the people that are now coming across the border that will be detained. So, and I think that they recognize that they would not be able to be having children and adults in what is classically criminal detention. But it is also true that if they are going to be prosecuting the adults, which is what triggers all of this, that those people then are in the hands of the Marshal Service and the Justice Department and need to go before a federal district court judge. And that's all, you know, criminal detention. So I think that the announcement that we saw today, which is that the Border Patrol will not be referring people right now for prosecution. The Justice Department has said that, of course, as soon as they get the referrals, they'll prosecute. But I think that that not referring for a while is the time of reconnoitering that is now taking place within the agencies themselves, having to decide how they are going to actually implement this order, because they don't have enough family detention space. They need to have appropriate family detention space, and they have to figure out very quickly how to pull that together. But at the same time, even though this has been, as you described it, you know, the implication is that this has been a setback for the president in that he had to back down on his earlier statements. Certainly that's true, and it's certainly true as a political take on it. But really, they have achieved with this action pretty much what they've wanted, which is the possibility of long-term detention for people crossing the border, even though they're parents and children, much narrowed standards for asylum so that far fewer people would actually be eligible for asylum, and then the opportunity to challenge this Flores decision, because under the Flores decision, they are not permitted to keep children in any kind of detention for more than 20 days, and they're required to keep children in the least restrictive setting. That had been extended more recently to include family groups, and so they now have the opportunity to go back to court and challenge that, and they have been wanting to be out from under the constraints of that decision. They'll now have a chance to do so, even if the district court that originally ruled to uphold these limitations continues to uphold them. They can appeal through the rest of, you know, up to the circuit court and the Supreme Court, and they're looking for a chance to get out from under those constraints.
So are you saying that basically we here in the press have been somewhat hoodwinked or distracted, that this is a rather cynical move? And I must say that, you know, having the First Lady down on the border today, that puts a human face on a pretty inhuman program. I wonder whether that's also being orchestrated. But just in general, the idea that the president in his executive order could actually make things even worse for those being detained, detain them indefinitely, and rip up the constraints of the Flores Agreement, which says that children kept in federal custody have to be placed in the least restrictive conditions possible and provided with some basic necessities like food and water, access to medical treatment, access to running water, and they must be separated from adults with whom they have no relationship. And that doesn't sound like where we're heading, does it?
Well, as I say, they're going to go to court on this, that they are right now bound by those restrictions, but they have been very opposed to those restrictions. They have characterized the results of those restrictions as catch and release. President campaigned strongly against catch and release, as they called it, during the campaign, and they have been very critical of it ever since. And it is certainly true that these court decisions, Flores, and the follow-up that then requires that the same conditions be applied to mothers, family units, that limits them, very much in being able to detain people, because they take the view that if you can't detain people, then they are not going to show up for their immigration court hearing that can then result in an order of deportation if they have an asylum case that is denied. So this, as I say, we have no idea what the court will decide, and it definitely takes time to appeal cases if the judge upholds the current opinion, but it puts it back into play in a way that they, the only other way that they have been able to approach this issue of the constraints is to ask Congress to pass legislation, because they characterize this Flores decision and the limited detention requirements, they characterize that as a loophole. That's one of the things that they've called a loophole. And so they've said, we're bound by these loopholes. It's the fault of Congress needs to fix this. Congress needs to pass legislation to fix it. The other way, of course, and we know that Congress hasn't been able to do that. And we see again today that the legislation has been postponed because they can't find agreement on legislation to send forward. Now, the legislation that they're talking about has enormous amounts of other provisions in it, but that's what the president has been beseeching the Congress to do. Now he has an opportunity to do that in court, and they have been looking for any way that they can to undo those limitations.
Well, in terms of the Congress not being able to make a deal, and of course the Senate has made it pretty clear that they're pretty skeptical of anything that comes out of the House, Trump is using the border wall, is he not, as leverage here? And he's using the border wall funding as leverage over DACA and the Dreamers. But that's separate, I guess, from what they're trying
right.
to undo.
But this family separation issue got right. tied up in that. I mean, that wasn't right. the original intent, but it got tied up in it quite quickly.
Right. So in terms of going through the courts, is it possible, though, that short of, and you say it could take some time, that in the meantime, could President Trump, which is frankly what it appears to be happening, could he do to the Flores Agreement what he's essentially been doing to the Affordable Care Act, which is chipping away with it, at it through sort of policy neglect, if you will, and neglect via implementation? In other words, are there bureaucratic tricks up his sleeve? For example, one of the provisions of the Flores Agreement is that all these facilities have to be inspected. And we don't even know where a lot of these facilities are. So it looks as though, in terms of inspections, we're way behind in that, if indeed these inspections are going on.
Well, we have to remember that there has been a very elaborate system in place for many years for placement of unaccompanied minors and other family kinds of cases. So this would not be the first time that there is family detention and all of the organizational, you know, mechanisms that are required to make it work. So that the different places around the country that we've heard already have been receiving children from the time when the family separation just began about a week ago, and actually even before the Attorney General's announcement about zero tolerance, their families were being separated. So young children were being sent, all children under the age of 18, but now particularly young ones, to different parts of the country. And we've seen reports of groups in New York, and there are some in Michigan, and I think some in Seattle and so forth, because the Department of Health and Human Services has the responsibility under a statute to take care of these children and place them in with a relative or with a parent or in the care of a foster situation. So all of that is in place. And the inspections that are required and the standards that are required, the contracts, they're all in place. The thing that is different now is that suddenly there has to be a really significant ramp up of that. And that takes a little time to do. And I'm sure that there are plenty of very skilled, effective people in the government that are nonetheless really, really having a difficult time trying to do their jobs because of the ramp up that is now called for.
Well, presumably there are people in the DHS and ICE and Border Patrol, etc., that are compassionate, and those that are a little cold-hearted. I mean, one, of course, was recorded on tape amid a bunch of wailing children, more or less saying, you know, this is an orchestra, you know, where's the conductor, which is pretty much a horrible notion put forth by people like Ann Coulter, who say that these children are being coached by a bunch of liberals to tug at our heartstrings, which seems a really callous rendering of what's really going on. So what would your take on that be, Doris Marger, in terms of how people are handling it within the government? Is it just a kind of reflects how the country itself is divided, for example?
Well, I don't know that we have any way of knowing that. What I do know is that the mission for which these people are trained and the work that they are there to do is very different from the tasks that they're now being given. And these decisions have been made without any advance planning. Just take the statements that were made a few weeks ago that people should no longer, if they want to claim asylum, come between the ports of entry, where what we're really trying to stop is illegal crossing of the border. If people do have a claim of asylum, they should come to a port of entry. Well, that was simply something that was said. Ports of entry, that may even be could certainly be a sensible way of doing things, but not if you don't have the capacity at ports of entry, if you haven't staffed up for it, if you don't have people that are trained to deal with these kinds of cases, if you don't have, if you're interrupting, you know, other traffic that's going back and forth, so that then we've seen different practices at different ports of entry all across the border because of these different infrastructure needs. And so, whatever one might say or not say about the people who work for the government, what their own views would be, that's not really germane. What's relevant here is the jobs that they are trained to do, the wherewithal that they have to do it, and the kind of a real operational crisis that is created when instructions just change on a whim without any planning to be able to carry them out effectively.
Well, what we know so far, you know, and as I say, very little press access has been given to these facilities, and obviously there are good reasons to protect the children and not show their faces, etc. But on the other hand, there's obviously a tremendous public outcry and outrage, and so people want to know what's going on inside these facilities. The press were allowed into the converted Walmart down in McAllen, Texas, run by a nonprofit called Southwest Key. And I talked to some of the reporters who went on that press tour. But now we're learning that the head of that organization is being paid $1.5 million this year, which is, in terms of nonprofits, that's considered way above what would be a reasonable salary. So is there a possibility that we're going to have a kind of, if you're saying that these families can be held in detentions for a long time, does that mean that this will be a kind of gold rush, if you will, for contractors, because the Defense Department's also being tasked with building tent cities? So what's your expectation there in terms of whether or not there's going to be an awful lot of money made out of this misery?
I'm sure that we can expect that there will be a good deal of that. This has all the potential for that kind of misuse. And, I mean, there certainly are some contractors and some contract facilities that are operating as they should, but there's a lot of room for abuse, particularly for abusive practices and for improper, as you say, salaries and so forth, and particularly when things have to be scaled up so quickly. So, similarly with what we've seen, the trends over decades now at the state level as well as at the federal level with private prisons, as compared to prisons and jails being the responsibility of public institutions, governments, and therefore accountable in ways to elected officials and to publics that are much less likely when things are operating under contract. I think this certainly has the potential for that kind of abuse and scandal and ultimately, you know, incredible amounts of exploitation of the people themselves and the taxpayer. I mean, I'll just give you one, you know, very important number. One does not have to keep people in detention in order for them to appear at their hearings. The reason for immigration detention is supposed to be sure that people come to their hearings before an immigration judge. And now, this zero tolerance is a different thing because they're trying to prosecute people criminally in federal courts. But in general, traditionally, immigration detention has been so people show up at their hearings. Well, you don't have to detain people. You can put ankle bracelets on them. You can have monitoring. There has been for many years, a very successful case management project that ICE ran that people checked in daily or had people that, you know, monitor their cases. 99% of them showed up for their hearings. It can be done. And if you do it that way, you're basically spending about $35 a day for a family. If you have a family in detention with in the way that is now being envisioned, you're going to be spending at a minimum $300 a day for the family. So we're talking about potential expenditures of millions of dollars to the taxpayer when there are other practices that are more humane, can be effective in people being in hearings, and also affordable.
Well, just in closing, Donald Trump obviously wants to appear tough, and he's made that clear. At the end of the day, though, no matter how tough and he and Sessions and Stephen Miller, who's apparently whispering in Trump's ear, no matter how tough they get, it's never going to be solved, is it? Because Jay Johnson, the former head of DHS, I saw him on television last night, making the point that, look, at the end of the day, unless conditions improve for people in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and that they can have live their lives without being so terrified that they have to move their kids to safety in the United States, unless you solve the problems at its source, it's never going to go away. What's your take on that?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we have to be involved. This is our region. This is our neighborhood geographically. We have to be involved in ways that address those conditions in those countries. It's in our national. It's in our self-interest to do so. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be enforcing our borders. Of course, we should be enforcing our borders. You know, this so much of what's going on now in the way that the rhetoric flies on this issue is, well, if you're not for this, then you're for open. If you're not for this kind of detention, then you're for open borders. That's ridiculous. Border security is, of course, important, and it's legitimate, and we have very good ways of doing it. But we now have different flows, and we need different responses for those different flows, and they are immediate responses, but they also have to be longer-term responses, such as what Secretary Johnson describes.
Well, Doris Meisner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Doris Meisner, who's the former commissioner of the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Bill Clinton, and she's now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, where she directs the Institute's U.S. immigration policy work. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an examination of our immigration prison system about to be gifted with a bonanza of pork barrel by Trump.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
place is a prison. And these people aren't your friends. There's guards at the on-ramps, armed to the teeth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Christina Fialo, who's the co-founder and co-executive director of Freedom for Immigrants, a nonprofit advocacy organization that seeks to abolish immigration detention, an attorney and human rights activist who has spent the last 15 years advocating for immigrants. She has an article at the Los Angeles Times, "Don't Stop with Family Separation, End the Whole Immigration Prison System." Welcome to Background Briefing, Christina Fialo.
Thank you, Ian.
And we were just speaking with Doris Marsden, the former commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Clinton. She actually signed the Flores Agreement, and she feels that what Trump is doing is actually very cynical, that people are crediting him with a change of mind and being influenced by his wife, who's down on the border. But maybe the two of them are pulling off a cynical ploy, which is to basically open the path to challenge the Flores Agreement that protects these children in custody, to get rid of that, and in effect to start a regime of indefinite detention, because we don't know whether the children are going to join their parents in jail or whether the parents are going to join their children in jail. But what we do know is that they're going to be building these prisons, and they're starting to. And this is a bonanza for prison contractors. And at the end of the day, the people are going to be worse off. So what's your take on it?
I couldn't agree more with that. You know, the Trump administration's new executive order to lock up these children really is a sentence for them to be locked up with their parents in for-profit immigrant prisons indefinitely. And that is not a real solution. You know, he is continuing to use babies really as a bargaining chip for his border wall. And that's absolutely disgusting. I know Americans want an immediate solution to this current brutality of ripping families apart, but detaining families together indefinitely is not a better option. And my organization, Freedom for Immigrants, has been visiting and monitoring immigration detention facilities for the last decade. And we've also piloted community accompaniment programs, which are an alternative to immigration detention. And they work. So we believe it's really time to abolish immigration detention. And that's really the only way to stop the separation of families. And we need to implement community accompaniment programs, through which relatives and local organizations take responsibility for making sure immigrants and asylum seekers can have their day in court with due process instead of being caged in a system that is deliberately set up to prevent them from accessing legal counsel or other support.
But it's my understanding that Jeff Sessions, in effect, is using this zero tolerance policy to criminalize something that was never meant to be criminal. In other words, the idea that people who come across the border into this country undocumented basically have to show up in immigration court. And the reason they're detained is to make sure they show up in immigration court. But you don't actually have to detain people to make sure they show up in immigration court. You can put them on, put ankle monitors on them, for example. You can have them stay with their relatives at no cost to the taxpayer and then make sure they show up in court. And apparently 90-something percent of people show up in court in any case. So is this whole thing completely ginned up as a way to make a bunch of contractors fat and happy by raiding the Treasury?
Definitely. And actually, prior to the 1980s, there were only about 30 to maybe 3,000 people held in immigration detention on any given day. But in 1983 and 1984, two private prison companies, Corrections Corporation of America, now known as CoreCivic, and GEO Group, were really formed and they began lobbying for laws that would expand not only our immigration detention system, but our mass incarceration system as a whole. And then in 1996, under President Bill Clinton, two laws were passed that greatly expanded our immigration detention system. But we don't need to imprison people. We can respond respond to migration, not by incarcerating people, but by welcoming them and helping them go through the immigration legal process without being incarcerated. So part of our work, as I mentioned, is community accompaniment programs. And studies in partnership with the government have shown that 93% of asylum seekers to 94% of non-citizens with past criminal convictions in these alternative programs show up for their immigration hearings. And on top of that, a pilot program conducted in 2015 with ICE found that it costs only $50 a day for a family to receive housing and wraparound services compared to about $800 per day that it costs taxpayers for a family to be imprisoned. And again, a lot of this money is going back to the for-profit prison companies that really formed this system.
So this, of course, is going on in Sacramento, too. The biggest lobbying organization in Sacramento is the Prison Guards Union. So there's a kind of symbiosis that builds up over the years. But at the moment, according to your article in the Los Angeles Times, Christina Fiallo, that there are approximately 34,000 to 40,000 people being held in immigration detentions, and the biggest one is outside of L.A., the Adelanto detention facility, where up to almost 2,000 immigrants are held. And you said you've been visiting these facilities now for the last couple of decades. What do you find in them? Because there was a report released on Wednesday by Human Rights Watch that found 15 deaths between December 2015 and April of 2017, eight of which were from inadequate medical care, and that overall since 2003, when ICE started, there have been 180 reported deaths in immigration detentions. Of course, these are amongst adults, I assume, but it obviously could get worse with children. We don't know what their physical condition is, but we certainly know that their mental condition is not good, being torn away from their mothers as young as, 18 months, I think, is the youngest.
Yes. Yeah, we have documented widespread sexual and physical abuse. We've documented medical neglect that has actually resulted in the death of adults in immigration detention. We've documented maggots in the food, abuse that's actually motivated by hate or bias, so basically hate crimes being perpetrated by ICE officers or contracted facility guards inside of these facilities. Last year, we released a report, for example, on widespread sexual assault in detention based on government data that we obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request, and we found that between 2010 and July 2016, there were over 33,000 complaints of sexual assault or physical abuse lodged with the Office of the Inspector General against DHS component agencies. And ICE received, of course, the largest number of those complaints. One of those complaints was from a young girl under 18 at the Carnes Residential Center in Texas. This is a family detention facility right now that's open. And this young girl filed a complaint about sexual assault that happened to her inside of this detention facility. A medical examination showed vaginal scarring and an STD, but ICE just declared the complaint unfounded so that they don't have to have additional eyes looking at what's happening behind these closed doors. So the system is really operating without any oversight, without the public really knowing where our taxpayer dollars are going. But what we have seen is that our taxpayer dollars are going towards perpetrating human and civil rights abuses.
Well, the Associated Press is reporting that immigrant children held in the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center in Virginia say they were handcuffed, beaten, left nude in concrete cells, and strapped to chairs with bags over their heads. And there's a lawsuit against the Shiloh Treatment Center near Houston, Texas, where the migrant children say they were forcibly administered drugs that, in fact, were these psychiatric drugs they were told were vitamins. Boy, that's really creepy. You know, that reminds you of the Nazi Dr. Mengele.
Yeah, that is exactly the type of abuse that we have seen, and it's disgusting. And again, this abuse is being perpetrated with our tax dollars. And right now, one of the major problems coming out of Trump's executive order is that no one is responsible for reuniting these families. So these children who've been separated, often violently, from their mothers and fathers, and then forced to endure this type of outright violence and abuse, there's no one looking out for how these families are going to be put back together. For example, we worked with one family whose child was ripped away from them. His name is Mateo. He's 1 year old. He was held for over 3 months away from his parents in one of these child prisons. His father remains detained right now, but when his mother was released from ICE custody, she immediately started looking for her child. It's like a kidnapping, really. There's no way to figure out where your child is being held. It took her months to find him and then weeks to be reunited with him after she found where he was located. She said it was like trying to adopt her own son. And now Mateo is traumatized from this separation. I mean, this separation is a permanent part of Mateo's psyche now, moving into his, you know, childhood, toddler years, and even into adulthood. And his mother says that he cries when he sees strangers and doesn't want anyone to hold him but his mother. And can you imagine then putting him and his mother into a private prison? That's what the Trump administration's executive order is saying. It's saying we're going to connect these families somehow, but we're not saying how, and we're going to put them into these private prisons. Well, that is exactly what should not be happening. We can't be re-traumatizing these families who have been separated and have gone through hell because of that separation.
Well, one of the contractors is MVM, which provided guards for CIA and military facilities in Iraq. Obviously, we're reminded of Abu Ghraib and all those atrocities. And they've gotten a contract with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to provide unaccompanied alien children transportation services worth $162 million. That was a contract just signed in April, led by President Trump. Just in closing, Christina Fiallo, you have described how horrible these facilities are, and we start out by saying that they're entirely unnecessary to begin with. The taxpayer could be saved a fortune if these immigrants were just given ankle bracelets and allowed to stay with families until their court hearings, which would then decide their fate. That is the legal process. That is the American way. Now it's changed under Trump, and he's using this, obviously, to rile up his base and saying the most poisonous, hateful things about immigrants, that they're murderers and rapists, and all of them are MS-13 gang members, and they're trying to infest our country. I guess at this point, what we have to conclude is that as bad as what you've told us this system is, then it's just going to get worse, isn't it? Because it's just going to get flooded. Nobody's dealing with the conditions in Central America, which is really the source of this problem. So if it's bad now, it's going to get worse, isn't it?
I think we're at a real turning point in our nation's history. For the first time in the last three decades, there is widespread knowledge of the fact that we are imprisoning people in immigration detention facilities who are just trying to come for a better life, who have been persecuted in their home countries. So we're really at a turning point where we can say, let's continue to incarcerate them. Let's expand that incarceration, which is what the Trump administration wants you to believe is our only solution. Or we can say, no, look, prior to the 1980s, our country did not respond to migration in this way. We can get back to that time, and we can do that by really putting our resources and our power into community-based alternatives to detention that don't include ankle monitors instead of imprisoning families.
Well, Christina Fiallo, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Christina Fiallo, who is the co-founder and co-executive director of Freedom for Immigrants, a nonprofit advocacy organization that seeks to abolish immigration detention, an attorney and human rights activist who has spent the last 15 years advocating for immigrants. She has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Don't Stop with Family Separation and the Whole Immigration Prison System. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into plans by the Trump administration to merge the Department of Labor with the Department of Education. Politics.
Politik needs human beings. Politik needs lies. That's why it's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Seth Harris, a distinguished scholar at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, who served over 4 years as Deputy U.S. Secretary of Labor and 6 months as Acting U.S. Secretary of Labor, a member of President Barack Obama's cabinet. He also chaired Obama for America's Labor, Employment and Workplace Policy Committee, and later founded the campaign's Disability Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Harris.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of this proposed merger of the Labor Department and the Education Department? Mick Mulvaney has been the point person on it. He's already gone into the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau largely to dismantle it. So are we to assume that he is still the wrecking crew?
I think this proposal certainly supports that hypothesis. I mean, this is a terrible idea. You might say it's a solution in search of a problem, but if you dig down a couple of levels, it becomes fairly clear that a significant motivation behind this proposal is to significantly weaken and de-emphasize the Labor Department's efforts to enforce a long list of worker protection laws, labor standards that keep workers safe, make sure they get paid what they're supposed to get paid, protect their pensions and health care, and make sure they get the workers' compensation benefits they're entitled to. So this is an ideologically driven proposal that's dressed up as an effort to streamline government.
And in terms of the Education Department, do they end up on top here? Who absorbs who in this proposal?
Well, it's very difficult to tell who absorbs who. It's actually something of a mashing together of the two organizations. It seems, based on the description of the proposal, that sizable portions of the Education Department's apparatus would remain intact and that the Labor Department would be sort of forced into that sort of a square peg in a round hole to make it work. What's confusing about the proposal is there doesn't seem to be any effort made to describe what programs they're trying to kill. How are they going to reorganize, restructure, end programs, create programs that will make the services of this combined organization better for workers, for students, for employers, for people with disabilities, for seniors, for people who sponsor retirement plans and health plans? There's no explanation of that because really it's just taking two organization charts and slamming them together.
Well, the Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, is one of the few people praising this plan, and her department's largest division oversees $1.4 trillion in federal student loans. She has rolled back protections for student loans for students with debt, and she's also rolled back protections for students who are being defrauded by these for-profit colleges, which get about between $30 and $40 billion of U.S. taxpayer money and by and large essentially saddle these young aspiring, mostly minority kids, veterans. They saddle them with a lifetime of debt and a worthless diploma. And it's an absolutely cruel and disgraceful racket. And she's enabled it even more, along with denying relief to students. I mean, don't you find that crazy that we are, instead of investing in our students as centers of investment, they are now being treated as centers of profit?
Well, that was the effort under the Obama administration's Education Department was to the extent possible, to remove profit from the educational system, to emphasize the lowest cost student loans for college, to put a lot of pressure on for-profit colleges to ensure that they were their graduates were getting gainful employment and that they weren't going to default on these federally guaranteed loans. So it was protection both for the students and for taxpayers. And you're right that Secretary DeVos is working very hard to undo all of that. She, I think, would tell you in a private moment that she would like to see the American education system privatized and turned into a profit center for Wall Street, if that were possible. At the same time, what she's doing is she's gutting civil rights protections for students with disabilities, for students of color, women on campus, weakening sexual harassment protection for women on campus. It's really, I think her record is really quite disgraceful. It's an interesting juxtaposition, actually, with Secretary Alex Acosta, with whom I have many disagreements, but he has not taken a wrecking ball to the Labor Department. I guess what this proposal to merge the Labor Department and the Education Department tells us is that that job has been left to the Office of Management and Budget and Director Mick Mulvaney, that Secretary Acosta can't be trusted to destroy more than 100 years of Labor Department history.
But in terms of the preparation for this merger that Mick Mulvaney's been conducting largely in secret, apparently they didn't consult any of the people inside of both the Department of Labor and the Department of Education who are federal employees as opposed to political employees. So whatever the brains trust, whatever the institutional memory is in these government departments, the Trump administration's point man, Mulvaney, wanted nothing to do with them. He didn't want input from them. So isn't that pretty scandalous, if not make you skeptical in the first place?
Well, I agree with that sentiment completely. I'm not sure it's a scandal, but it's certainly a terrible idea. You know, these organizations are very large and very complicated, and they have developed over the years very sophisticated approaches to dealing with the problems that they are charged with solving. And there are people inside these organizations, good, solid, nonpartisan, committed public servants who've given their professional lives to serving the missions of these organizations. They are experts in how these organizations work. And let me just say, they work very closely with their counterparts in other agencies. So the folks in the Labor Department who are responsible for workforce development, job training, adult education, work very closely with their partners in the Education Department, just as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration works closely with the folks in the National Institutes of Health, NIOSH, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, on worker safety and health, just as the folks who protect pensions and health plans work closely with the Treasury Department, the Department of Health and Human Services. There is a network. It doesn't matter what building you sit in. These folks are experts. They are knowledgeable. They work well together. The argument in the proposal that Mick Mulvaney has put forward, that these are silos, suggesting that folks don't talk to one another, they have nothing to do with one another, that is just false. It is not in any way true. They're all well connected. They work closely together. They understand one another's programs. And wherever there is an opportunity for them to work together, they find the opportunity to do that. This false caricature of government employees as close-minded, territorial people who sit in their office protecting their turf is just unfair and false, and it's the premise for this proposal.
So, Seth Harris, politically, though, this doesn't seem to be as terrible and mendacious as it appears to be with all of the hidden agendas that we've been talking about to destroy rather than to consolidate and make more efficient. Senator Patty Murray, who's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Education Committee, said today she called the plan unrealistic, unhelpful, and futile. The chair, Lamar Alexander, suggested that he'd look at it, but he didn't display any enthusiasm. So is this dead on arrival?
Yes.
Oh, that's good news, isn't it? I mean,
it is. It is. There's, you know, what Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander understand that Mick Mulvaney does not is that these kinds of consolidation and reorganization efforts are extremely costly, fantastically time-consuming, deeply complicated, and largely do not produce better outcomes. So what you have to do is take each proposal on its own merits and look at the costs and benefits. Mick Mulvaney's proposal doesn't lay out costs and benefits. It's just a rhetorical document. It's almost as though it's written to make a point, not to actually advance an agenda beyond making a rhetorical point. It's not really designed to be implemented. It's not designed for Congress to act on it. It's really just the Trump administration trying to make a point that it is populated by small government conservatives, while actually government is growing under President Trump, and we are wasting a great deal of money under President Trump. So this is just, I think that we should see this as nothing more than a press release that's designed to make a point, and it won't really have a life beyond maybe one congressional hearing over the next week or two, and then it won't be discussed ever again.
So does that mean that the point that they're making is that you and I are talking about something and we're essentially being manipulated by a government that operates on the principle of government by stunt? There's no substance to what they do. It's a reality TV show, and every day they throw some red meat to distract us, particularly from the Mueller inquiry, from the horrendous images coming from our southern border with crying children being ripped from their mother's arms. Is that what's going on here?
Well, let me just say, if you were trying to distract from the catastrophe on our southern border or the Mueller investigation, this is a pretty weak way of doing it, because I actually think that this proposal is not going to gain very much attention. Most of the most knowledgeable observers are going to say what I have been saying, which is this is not going anywhere. There's no need to pay any attention to it. And let me also say, for most Americans, you know, what box is inside what other box in the U.S. government doesn't really matter a great deal in their day-to-day lives. What they care about is whether or not government is delivering the services that they are paying for. Are they getting the job training they need? Are they being protected from workplace injuries and illnesses? Is their pension secure? Are they getting the wage that they're entitled to? Is there a Social Security benefit check showing up? Are their kids able to get the student loans that they're entitled to? If they're discriminated against, is there somebody at the other end of the phone who's going to respond and help to resolve the dispute and make sure that the discrimination is eliminated? That's what the American people care about. So this, for most people, is just moving chairs around a dinner table. It doesn't really affect what the meal is at all. So I think no one is really going to be fooled. Again, I think that this is one conversation that you and I need to have, and we probably won't ever have to talk about this proposal again.
Well, I'm gratified to hear that, but I still feel to some extent we're being manipulated, even if it's not necessarily effective. The notion of government by stunt is to make it look as if Trump is achieving something and getting something done, when it seems like this is the most amateurish bunch of unqualified people we've ever had in government. And most of them, their function is to destroy the very department that they're in charge of.
Well, let me say, I agree with you about the lack of competence. This is not, and this is evidence, I think, of an administration that just has not demonstrated basic competence in government administration. And it's, you know, we can't write that off merely to an ideology that is for small government and that wants to eliminate as much of government as they possibly can and is, you know, rabid about waste, fraud, and abuse even where it doesn't exist. They have been unable in many instances to hire people who actually are good at the jobs that are required to manage a government. As I said, this is a gigantic enterprise. The federal government is a gigantic enterprise. The Labor Department alone is a multi-billion dollar organization with 23 operating units. It is hard to run, and I say that as somebody who ran it for 5 years. It's extremely challenging to do this. It takes people who really know what they're doing and really care about the success of the organizations in order to manage these organizations successfully. This proposal, because it is so shockingly ignorant of how the Labor Department and the Education Department work, and it shows no insight into how government can be successfully managed, demonstrates that the people who are producing these proposals really are not competent at their jobs. And we, as Americans, we should all be concerned about that because, you know, this is a big, powerful organization. It needs to be run right by people who want it to run right, and that's not what we have right now.
Well, that was pretty evident in the confirmation hearings for Betsy DeVos. She barely squeaked by, but nevertheless, she's in there, and that's what's frightening is that as a journalist, every day I'm trying to keep up with President Trump. And again, I feel like I'm being constantly distracted and manipulated. But let's just, in closing, Seth Harris, talk a little bit about the 2014 Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which brought together the Education and Labor Departments. So that's being cited as something that they can build on. What do you understand about those? Is this a harbinger of something good or something bad?
Well, this proposal really has nothing whatsoever to do with that law that was enacted in 2014. What that law did was to reauthorize a number of programs that provide education, job training, workforce development assistance, job placement assistance to the American people. And it's a very good bill. And let me just say, Congress, if it had wanted to in that bill, could have consolidated some of these job training, education, and workforce development functions, and Congress very consciously chose not to do that. Instead, they kept those organizations like Job Corps, like the Perkins program, like vocational education, like the workforce development system that's run by the Labor Department. It kept them where they are. It urged them to work more closely together. It restructured the system that's designed to get them to work more closely together. It gave them common sets of performance measures to make sure they're all aiming for the same goal. But it said absolutely nothing about consolidating boxes in the way that Mick Mulvaney is suggesting that they should be. So that's another red herring, a false argument that we really shouldn't take seriously. But we should take seriously that the most important thing in all of these programs, particularly the job training programs, is outcomes. How do we make sure that the American people get the skills and education and the job placement assistance they need so that they will end up in good, solid, middle-class jobs? And that's what the WEOA Act was about. And I think that both the Labor Department and the Education Department, based on my personal experience and my continuing relationships with those organizations, I think that's their goal, is to carry it out as Congress enacted it.
Well, Seth Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Harris, a distinguished scholar at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, who served over 4 years as Deputy U.S. Secretary of Labor and 6 months as Acting U.S. Secretary of Labor, a member of President Barack Obama's cabinet. He also chaired Obama for America's Labor, Employment and Workplace Policy Committee and later founded the campaign's Disability Policy Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Grant Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.